Okay, so my topic relates to sodium and its impact on health and on public health strategies to prevent the adverse consequences of excess sodium intake. So let me make sure I got this straight here. Maybe I need to use this. Okay. So I don't have any disclosures. One of the things about being an advocate of nutrients to reduce is there are almost no disclosures ever in your life. You can't make money off this thing. In fact, I drove down here. I might get a parking ticket because I parked on the street, so that's why. Okay. So so this is the outline of my talk. I'm going to start off with talking about blood pressure as a public health concern, the adverse effects of excess sodium intake. I'll talk about sodium intake sources and amount, and then recent policy making efforts and public health efforts. So I always start off my talks with this, mentioning nomenclature, because if you follow literature, there's a lot of different ways we describe the intake of sodium, or it also commonly interchange with salt. I'll use as a reference points the general recommendation, the left column, currently recommended upper limit of intake as recommended in U.S. dietary guidelines is 2,300 milligrams for the general population, that's adults. That corresponds to 100 millimoles of sodium. And if you're talking about salt, which is sodium chloride, that's 5.8 grams. So in Europe, they actually focus on salt and rather than sodium in terms of providing guidance. Now, this is a slide. It might be better if the lights are a little bit lower. But this is the big picture issue in terms of leading causes of death worldwide. This is from a WHO report in December 2009. And high blood pressure is the leading cause of death worldwide, followed by smoking and then other modifiable risk factors. Actually, most of them are of interest are related to lifestyle factors, diet, and physical activity. But that's why blood pressure is such a big deal. And the more we learn about blood pressure, the more we realize that this is a huge public health concern. So in terms of the magnitude of the blood pressure epidemic, it's been estimated that 54% of strokes and 47% of coronary heart disease events can be attributed to elevated blood pressure, and that roughly 26% of adults, or nearly a billion individuals, have hypertension, and that's defined by a systolic blood pressure greater than 140, diastolic greater than 90, and or use of medications. But I like making this very personal, which is that the lower your risk, the lower your blood pressure, the lower your risk of heart disease and stroke. And that's even if you don't have hypertension. The risk relationship is graded, and I'll show that on the next slide. And also important, this is data from Framingham, your lifetime risk of developing hypertension is 90%. And that's because, and I'll show you, as we age, blood pressure rises not just during adulthood, but also during childhood. And this is a graph of the risk relationship between blood pressure and stroke mortality. But the same is true also for coronary heart disease. And each of those four lines corresponds to a different decile of life. So I'm on the lowest line, 50 to 59, and what you see is a progressive graded risk relationship. And it's that relationship is evident not just to the right of that line, which is the clinical definition of hypertension, a systolic blood pressure of greater than 140, but it's also true with blood pressures left of that line. So if your blood pressure is a systolic of 130, your risk of stroke is reduced if you could lower your blood pressure to a systolic blood pressure of 120. Now, there are lots of different types of evidence relating salt intake to blood pressure. There's epidemiologic studies, migration studies, genetic studies. Interestingly, virtually every genetic defect that's been associated with either elevated or low levels of blood pressure affects sodium handling by the kidney. In the animal, in animal models, virtually all forms of hypertension are aggravated by salt. We have lots of trials. Some of them are better than others, and the best studies document risk relationships. And we also have population-based interventions, specifically interventions done in northern Japan, Portuguese villages. There are also interventions that are ongoing, or that actually more recently in Finland and the UK. I want to cover a concept called salt sensitivity, which has sort of a thorn in the side of public health efforts. And that is that we can identify groups of individuals that have a greater response to sodium reduction, but there's tremendous variability within group, and it's impossible to identify individuals that are so-called salt-sensitive. And if you've ever been to a doctor, and you know, you could ask them, well, I'd like to determine if I'm salt-sensitive. There's absolutely no clinical test, you know. And so it's sort of a common ruse that people will say, well, we need to target this intervention to individuals who might be salt-sensitive, but we really don't have any means to identify. So my view is that this is irrelevant as a public health concept, given the vast scope of the blood pressure and cardiovascular disease epidemics. There are factors that are associated with increased salt sensitivity, and those are what are called fixed factors. African Americans tend to be more salt sensitive, as do middle and older age individuals, the genetic people with certain genetic factors, and then individuals who are hypertensive, have diabetes or chronic kidney disease. And certain ones are modifiable, and we, in our, some of the studies we've done, have noted that if individuals have are on a low potassium diet or a poor quality diet, they have a exaggerated blood pressure response to sodium intake. So here are some data from the DASH sodium trial, and what it shows is that on average, African Americans and non-African Americans have lower blood pressure and lower sodium intake, but African Americans have a greater blood pressure response to a given reduction in sodium intake. But I always emphasize that it's not as though non-African Americans have no response, it's just a bit less. And the same is true by age, and this has been documented in a variety of different kinds of studies, that individuals who are older age have greater blood pressure response to reducing sodium than those who are younger. Brings us to the notion of shifting the distribution of blood pressure and its potential benefits. So these were concepts that were initially promulgated by Godfrey Rose and have gained traction and really are the basis for our prevention guidelines for hypertension. So if you have a distribution of blood pressure, then, and it is roughly Gaussian, and you're able to shift it by just a small amount, the benefits are actually quite substantial. So if you go just down to that middle row, a shift in the blood pressure distribution of 3 millimeters of mercury systolic is estimated to reduce mortality from stroke by about 8%, CHD by 5%, and total mortality by 4%. And I think the benefits of sodium reduction are actually of a greater magnitude than that, especially in middle and older age individuals. And multiple attempts to sort of aggregate the data, and these are results of meta-analysis with the exception of the column on the right, resistant hypertension. But in children, blood pressure on average is lower if sodium is reduced. Same thing with non-hypertensive adults and hypertensive adults. And you see the average is 5 millimeters mercury, which is actually huge from a public health perspective. And then there are very few studies in people with very high levels resistant hypertension, because those people typically get treated. You just can't do long-term experiments. But there's a really interesting study that was published in Hypertension about 2 years ago. And it took individuals who had resistant hypertension. And in the clinical field, these people are getting treated with multiple medications or even surgical therapy now. But these people were randomized to a reduced sodium diet versus normal sodium, and the blood pressure reductions from reduced sodium were really impressive. And these are people who have poorly controlled hypertension. Now, over the past several years, there have been several efforts to identify the potential benefit of modifying or improving modifiable risk factors, and this is one of the major studies from DENAI. And the idea was, say, well, what if we reduce blood pressure to optimal levels? What if people stop smoking? What if people were no longer overweight or obese? Or we got people to reduce their dietary sodium intake to 2,300. And the estimated benefit in terms of the number of deaths prevented is actually substantial. These are the top 10. So if you're able to reduce dietary sodium intake, I think this was to 2,300 milligrams, you'd prevent on an annual basis roughly 100,000 lives. A more, I think, persuasive analysis was done by Bibbins Domingo and published in New England Journal last year. And they have a model in which they can estimate the number of prevented heart attacks, deaths, and cost from a variety of different interventions. So these were two population-based, or estimates of population-based reduction of sodium. The left was 400 milligrams per day, relatively small amount, and then a sodium reduction of 1,200 milligrams per day, which is reducing average intake by roughly a third, and you can again see substantial reductions. And what's interesting is that it compares very nicely and with drug therapy for hypertension, smoking cessation if you were to get people, 50% of people to stop, or weight loss of 5%. Now, of course, these are projections. We don't have randomized trials that have, compared, at the same time, each of these, but they are very plausible sets of data that have gone into these estimates. So I think we need to think of sodium intake on the same, on the same level or playing field as these other interventions that we think about as potentially, more beneficial, like smoking cessation or weight loss or drug therapy for hypertension. Let me get back to a concept I mentioned earlier, which is that the age-related rise in blood pressure, which occurs insidiously as we age, probably beginning at birth, but these are data in adults, and on average, blood pressure rises about 0.6 millimeters of mercury per year, and this is in adults. What's interesting is that in children, the same thing occurs, but maybe even more briskly. In boys, blood pressure rises by about 1.9. That's really three times the rate in adults. And in girls, it's 1.5 millimeters of mercury per year. And interestingly, the reason I show this is that there are countries or regions, actually, of the world where blood pressure is not very high. The Yanomami Indians in Brazil and Venezuela are one such area. And I plotted the mean levels in adults ages 20 to 59. So in men, the average blood pressure in people roughly our age is 101. That's their average blood pressure. That's typical. And that maps out to the average blood pressure of boys in the United States of age 11. And then in women, the average blood pressure in Yanomami women is 91. That's the average. And that maps out to a blood pressure of around 7 in girls. So what that means to me is that the blood pressure problem that we often deal with in adults and older people really has its genesis early in life, and that if you're going to have really put a big dent in the blood pressure epidemic, you need to start early with children. And maybe even really early. There's one clinical trial in which infants were fed formula with usual sodium levels versus a reduced, and this was in newborn infants, and they measured blood pressure over 25 weeks, and they documented a 2.1 millimeter difference between the two randomized groups. Interestingly, they were able to follow up a good fraction of those individuals, and those that had been randomized to the reduced sodium formula actually persisted in having a lower blood pressure by age 15. So it might be even a memory effect or some sort of programming effect from reduced sodium intake early in life. All right, let me now move on to usual sodium consumption sources and amount. Virtually 90% of the sodium we consume comes in the form of sodium chloride. There are several other forms, sodium bicarbonate, sodium citrate, sodium with other anions. Often those are for preservatives or some other property. If you try to estimate the amount of sodium that is consumed in the food supply, that individuals consume, this is national data from NHANES, virtually everybody is above the 1,500 milligrams, which has been recommended for adults who are in high-risk groups, and most groups over the 2,300 milligrams, and everybody over the 200 milligrams. That's the lower line, which many people think is all we need in order to replace the sodium that we lose insensibly. The data on where sodium comes from have been pretty consistent. It's really most of the food, at least in the United States, or sodium comes from food processing. Around 12% is inherent in the food. That is that the food, as it's grown, has a certain amount of sodium in it. It's often very low. And then very little actually comes from what's added at the table and during cooking. This is actually old data, limited number of people. The study should be replicated now, but I think it's still probably the general pattern is probably true. The same may not be true, though, in other countries, and this might be relevant as we think about the U.S. various subpopulations in the United States. In China, the amount of sodium, the major source is not processed foods. It's actually sodium added to foods, and that's actually true in other countries, including countries in sub-Saharan Africa, whereas United States, UK, it's really processed foods. The dominant or predominant source of sodium in China and Japan is soy sauce, and in the UK and the US, it's breads, grains, and cereals. Most people really don't even think about it. The average person does not think about those as sources of sodium, but that's where we get most of our sodium, the bread that we have with our meals. Okay, let me move on to the last topic, which is recent policymaking and public health efforts. Policymaking has included the Institute of Medicine Committee on Strategies to Reduce Sodium Intake, Institute of Medicine Committee on Achieving Blood Pressure Control, 2010 U.S. Dietary Guidelines, and the 2020 American Heart Association Strategic Impact Goals. So the 2010 Dietary Guidelines sodium recommendation was to reduce intake to less than 2,300 milligrams and to reduce it further in the groups that are listed here to 1,500 milligrams. What's of interest to many of us is that this lower limit actually applies to over half the population, and many of us believe that the 1,500 milligrams should be the goal, and that was advocated by the American Heart Association. I think we've been repeatedly stated we need immediate deliberate action, and it's going to require food manufacturers actually to make that happen. So there are some issues that came up during the dietary guidelines I thought I would just go over. The first thing is that while some foods are really high in sodium, the problem of excess sodium reflects frequent consumption of foods that are only modestly elevated. So it's the piece of bread that has 150 milligrams, but if you have three or four pieces of bread, you're already up to 600 milligrams. It's not the salty soup for the most part. A new concern that seems to be under the radar at this point is the excessive sodium that's added to products such as poultry, pork, and fish through injections or marinations. And we recommended that efforts be made to quantify this type and actually discourage that type of food processing. And then an important determinant of sodium intake is actually calorie intake, and efforts to reduce calorie intake might also lower sodium intake. In terms of strategies to reduce sodium intake, I think the roadmap is pretty clear, and the major reason we had this IOM committee. The context of this is that basically our efforts to reduce sodium have been sort of like educational or very weak public health efforts have failed, and that we need innovative strategies to reduce sodium and get all manufacturers, not just certain or those that are enlightened, to make the changes. So the primary strategy was to set standards for sodium intake using the existing FDA authorities and modify the generally recognized as safe status of salt and other containing sodium-containing compounds. Interim strategies, that could take a long time, of course. The FDA does not move quickly. And I think the interim strategies are to still push hard on voluntary mechanisms. And the one that is perhaps the most likely to succeed is the effort that's going on in New York City. It's called the National Salt Reduction Initiative. It's not just New York City, it involves many cities and many states that they're using purchasing power, the power of the purse, to actually to accomplish sodium reduction. So with that, I'll end here. So first, the estimated benefits of salt reduction are substantial and warrant major public health efforts. These efforts are underway and I think are actually escalating. And I heard from Steve Havis today that the APHA has recommended a 1,500 milligram target, and also that the FDA moves swiftly, I think within 1 year, to towards that goal. The food industry really does have a pivotal role in whether or not meaningful sodium reduction occurs. Thank you very much.